I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 13th of August. Mark Niket is a reporter for Bloomberg News, and he wrote a piece that caught our attention. Governors who would be president have mixed records on miracles. He explored the economic records of 10 governors and ex-governors who would like to occupy the White House in 2016. He considered 11 economic indicators, and that's what we will do this hour of the program. We'll be welcoming phone calls. We're going to look at a number of candidates, Rick Perry, Governor Scott Walker, of course, Jeb Bush, and a number of others, because there are 10 of them. Have they created jobs? What have they done to grow businesses? And what record is the most stellar, and what record is the least stellar? We'll talk about all of that this hour. Welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Tonight opens Irish Fest, the 35th. Irish Fest. I think I've done shows for all 35 years on Irish Fest, and we're going to have musicians with us and an author and a vice president of Irish Fest to talk about what has now become the largest Celtic musical and literary celebration in the world. So that's coming up for our annual Irish Fest show, hour two of the program. Mark, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Before we talk about all these indicators, what do you think about governors having a better chance of winning the White House than somebody who is a senator, say, or a member of Congress, or a neurosurgeon, or somebody else? Is it a good track for a presidential run?
I think it is. And if you talk to the governors, they'll definitely tell you that it's great training ground to be a president. The governors will say, as their state chief executives, they're required to make decisions, balance budgets, you know, sort of run their states in the same way that the president does at a much larger level, and that they're leaders. So if you talk to the governors, they'll definitely tell you, you know, it's great experience to be a governor and take that into the Oval Office in a way that legislators don't have to make decisions and provide leadership along those lines. And, of course, if you talk to the legislators, they'll tell you that governors have no experience in foreign policy or world affairs or some of the other things that are important to being a president.
Mm-hmm. What were the 11 economic indicators that you looked at to rank the governors and ex-governors?
Well, we looked at a range of indicators that would sort of give us a picture of the whole economy. There's a lot of indicators you could look at, but we started with jobs. You know, what was the percentage change in the number of non-farm jobs as the government tracks it? We looked at unemployment. We looked at a number of businesses that were created, the state's gross domestic product, change in poverty status, per capita personal income, the unemployment rate in each state, the amount of state debt, population change, educational attainment, spending in the economy, and housing prices. And it was a little bit difficult comparison because it's not possible to compare these governors directly against each other because they served in different times and different economic times. Some are still in office, obviously, so you can look at how they stack up against each other. But across all 10, you know, very different time periods. So what we decided was fair was to look at how each governor ranked against all the other states during the time they were in office. So, for example, if we look at jobs, how did the job performance of Florida under the time that Jeb Bush was in office compare against all his colleagues during that same period and rank the states and show what Florida's ranking would have been during that time? And we did that for each of the governors across these 11 indicators.
Isn't it amazing how many governors are in this race?
It's a record number, believe it or not. I checked with some folks at the Eagleton Institute who follow governors and presidential races, and they tell me that there's never been this many governors running for president. The closest that we've ever seen is 1912, and I think only about half as many governors as we have running today were running then.
Amazing. All right, well, let's start with the front runner here in your categories. Under Jeb Bush, Florida had the highest median ranking, you say, at number 7, scoring higher in more categories than any other state.
Right, and again, we're not looking at how, you know, Bush compared against all the other governors in the race, but what we thought was looking at these categories, what's the median of their ranking across all 11? Bush comes out the highest at 11, and Texas Governor Rick Perry was next at second, with a median of 11. And Ohio Governor John Kasich was third with a median ranking of 17 across all 11 categories.
Mm-hmm. And have they been using some of your indicators as their campaign themes?
Yes. In fact, one of the reasons we did the story was if you talk to the governors and as you listen to them out on the campaign trail, they'll often make the case that they can do for the country what they did for their states. You know, they'll promote their economic records at home, what they were able to accomplish, the highlights of their performance, and say, well, that gives me experience, and that's why you should elect me president. And we couch the story in terms of miracles because it's sometimes expressed that way. The governors, maybe not always themselves, maybe it's their supporters, will get up and talk about how it was a miracle that what their economy was able to accomplish under their leadership. And part of what the story tried to point out and what the economic indicators show, the rankings, that, you know, it's not always, you know, a miracle that you know, is part of the record. That if you look at the numbers, you know, certainly it can be a mixed record. But more importantly, perhaps, there's other things going on in the economy that a governor has nothing to do with, has mm-hmm. no control over, that either could help or hurt what the economic performance is. For example, take Jeb Bush, you know, who came out the best in the rankings, at least across the medians. You know, one of the things that's mentioned when it comes to his performance in office is that the Florida economy did very, very well while he was governor. But it was also a time when there was a big housing bubble going on, and the housing economy, the housing market in Florida helped the overall economic performance of the state. In fact, we asked the folks at Zillow to do some calculations, and by their figuring that about a quarter of the economic growth in Florida during the time Bush was in office could be attributed to this housing bubble. And in fact, when the bubble burst after Jeb Bush left office, you could see the impact of the housing market there, too, because during the 4 years after Bush left office, only Nevada lost a greater percentage of jobs than Florida during that time. So the point is there's underlying factors within an economy that a governor can't control that can help or hurt the record. Same thing with Governor Perry in Texas. Texas economy has a history of oil and gas boom and bust cycles, and he was in office during a boom cycle, so the numbers look good there. Mm-hmm. And it sort of gets to a bottom line question, too, of how much credit or blame does a governor really deserve for economic performance of a state, because certainly there are a lot of forces, both national and international, that have a factor, play a role in what happens with their economy and the numbers that are generated, you know, as well as, you know, specific conditions like I mentioned in the state. And you could argue the same thing for the country, too. You know, how much credit or blame does a president deserve for the economy? And certainly there are things that the politicians and the leaders control by way of policy that will move the needle on these numbers. But, you know, the bigger picture is there's a lot of factors, too, at play that, you know, aren't controlled by the leaders.
And you make the point in writing about this that some of the job creation by some of these governors may have looked great, but you had to look at the kinds of jobs that were created. Some of them may not have been much above minimum wage.
Right, exactly. In Florida, for example, the miracle that Governor Perry talks about, the Texas miracle, was that the state was able to create jobs while the rest of the country was losing jobs during the recession. In fact, one of the stats he uses, and it's true, that during his tenure, Texas created almost one-third of the nation's new jobs during that period. But when you dig a little deeper, like you said, those jobs don't always translate into a higher standard of living. Almost 6% of the hourly workers in Texas make the federal minimum wage, for example, or less, and that compares to about 4% nationally. So a lot of these were minimum wage jobs that, you know, maybe weren't necessarily a living wage. And also, Florida is one of the highest states in terms of residents who lacked health insurance. So job creation looks good, but that's not the full story.
Mm-hmm. New Jersey, Chris Christie, you write, said he inherited an economic calamity when he took office in January of 2010. Has he improved the economy?
He has, and one of the things that it sort of runs through, particularly the governors who are in office now, is that they took office either during the teeth of or coming out of the Great Recession, you know, the worst recession we've had since the Great Depression. So their numbers, you know, sort of had nowhere to go but up in a lot of cases. Like for Christie's sake, Christie's example, you know, he did improve the unemployment rate in New Jersey, and you can look at, you know, increase in jobs compared with a loss of jobs, you know, before he took office. But it's kind of relative because, again, it's coming, you know, on the heels of a recession. So when these governors get up and talk about how great their record is, in some cases it's building off of what was a terrible, you know, economic period in our history. And one of the things that Chris Christie in particular has to deal with on the campaign trail is that there are other things that weigh against his record. For example, if you look at his job total, and again, if you look at the ranking of New Jersey during the time he's been in office against all other states, New Jersey ranks 47th in job growth. And he's also had problems with their pension system there. New Jersey's credit rating has been downgraded 9 times under Christie, which is the most for a state governor in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who promised and was taken to task during the debate last Thursday. He promised when elected that he would create 250,000 jobs in the state of Wisconsin. Half of those jobs have become a reality. How do you rank him?
Well, he comes out a median ranking, I think, somewhere in the middle of the pack. And you're right, sort of the most prominent feature of his economic record was that job promise he made before he took office, right? He was going to create 250,000 new jobs by the end of his first term. And, of course, when a politician throws a number out like that, you know, everybody follows to see if it came true. And obviously they did in Wisconsin, and it was about half that number that was actually created. And if you look at his total job creation performance compared with the other states, it's about 34th, and the percentage change in jobs under Scott Walker in Wisconsin is less than the U.S. average. It was 5.13% in Wisconsin and 8.42% nationwide. So, you know, because you can't really say you met that promise, what Governor Walker likes to say on the campaign trail is he talks about other things that are positive. He mentions a lot about how Wisconsin was able to increase its rainy day fund by 165 times from when he took office, or that their pension system is fully funded. And he kind of downplays the job performance, talks about that in terms of, you know, again, inheriting a mess and how, you know, Wisconsin had lost 133,000 jobs during his Democratic predecessor, and how, you know, he set high goals and, again, had sort of improved what was a bad situation.
Mm-hmm. When you look at all of these indicators in terms of helping the U.S. economy, in terms of what is most important among the indicators to a presidency, is it job creation or is it one of the other indicators or many of the other indicators, Mark?
Well, you'll get a debate on this, depending on who you talk to and what economist is looking at it. But I think generally there's an agreement that jobs is the most important indicator, just because of how important it is to the overall economy. If you have job growth, that means you probably have other good things going on in your economy. Spending is taking place. Business creation is moving forward. Population growth. So there's a lot of indicators that are sort of springboards or would be affected by job creation. And, you know, even rhetorically, a lot of governors will tell you the most important economic tool is to create a job, because once somebody has a job, they're less likely to be involved in, you know, crime or on public assistance or other factors that might weigh against the economic performance.
Mm-hmm. Talk about inheriting a difficult situation. Bobby Jindal in Louisiana, the conditions that when he took office were deplorable. It's a difficult state, I'm sure, to govern. You do write that he has reversed a 25-year trend of out-migration, but unemployment is still very, very high in that state, and the poverty rate is still high, isn't it?
Right, exactly. And he does like to emphasize on the campaign trail about that trend of out-migration, which just means, you know, more people leaving the state than coming into the state. And that did change, although if you look at the timeline, that trend started to change the year before he took office, so he can't claim credit entirely for that outcome. And you're right, when you look at the overall economy, there's still things that weigh against his performance, in particular the poverty rate and the unemployment rate increase that took place while he was in office.
Mm-hmm. And there is a Democrat on the list, former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley. He talks about raising the minimum wage, highest median income in America, sustaining that. But you point to the federal government having a huge influence in that state.
Right. In fact, the statistics he puts out that you mentioned are true. You know, Maryland does have higher median income, and the other factors do check out when you look at the numbers. But as, you're right, as we tried to point out, you know, the underlying factor at play in a state like Maryland is the presence that the federal government has by way of employment and spending in the state, which, again, a governor doesn't have anything to do with. And we talked to an economist who estimated that about 20% of the workforce in Maryland could be attributed to either a direct federal job or a contractor for the federal government. And these jobs tend to be filled by folks who are older or better paid than the average state worker there. So that's a factor that would sort of help, you know, a state like Maryland achieve a high median income, and might be an explanation behind the rankings and the performance that he had there. And the comment from the economist in that regard was, when the federal government sneezes, we all catch colds over here in Maryland. Again, just to sort of emphasize that, you know, what happens outside of the purview of the governor's office can sometimes help or hurt, because in the case of the federal government, when there's a, you know, sequestration or some government shutdown, that can work against a state like Maryland that is over-reliant on federal jobs and spending, at least compared with other states.
Mm-hmm. Ohio's John Kasich, he says that 350,000 jobs were lost during his Democratic predecessors last year. Is that accurate? That's a lot of jobs.
It is a lot of jobs, and Ohio was in a tough spot. It was a state that was heavily reliant on manufacturing. Manufacturing in particular took a blow during the recession, and, you know, the numbers pan out. What he says is true. You know, Ohio lost that many jobs during the recession under his predecessor. What he doesn't tell people, and what we point out in our story, is that the economy had started to recover even before Governor Kasich took office. In fact, in the last year his Democratic predecessor was in office, the state added about 59,000 jobs. So the trend had started towards recovery, you know, as the economy nationally was improving, and Ohio, you know, was part of that. And it sort of gets back to the whole, you know, who do you blame and who do you credit? You know, his predecessor gets a lot of blame for losing all these jobs. In fact, he's running for the U.S. Senate now here in Ohio. His name is Ted Strickland. He's the former governor. And that's a big feature of the campaign against him. You know, why would you elect a governor who lost 350,000 jobs on his watch? And he'll come back and tell you, well, you can't blame me for, you know, what was, in this case, you know, a national recession. In fact, the worst recession since the Great Depression.
Yeah. We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest. Mark Niket is with us. He's a reporter for Bloomberg News and did a very interesting piece looking at the economic records of 10 governors and former governors who are running for president in 2016. I think we got through all 10 of them. I don't know. I wasn't writing it down, but I think we did. Is this an important issue for you as you ponder, as you'll have a lot of time to ponder who you're going to support for the run for the presidency? What do you make of what he said about each of the 10 governors? Is there one or another that strikes your fancy? Are these indicators important to you? It's interesting how you can take a set of numbers and a time that wasn't very good in American history with the Great Recession, as Mark indicated, and things starting to get better when some of these governors took over, but that they could make a case that things were horrible, and then I took over and things got better. But nationally, things were getting better as well. Obviously, there will be interest in Governor Scott Walker in the state of Wisconsin, who promised that there would be 250,000 jobs created when he was governor, and only half have materialized. Is that important that he announced that, or do you give him a break on that and figure that he's got more time to create those jobs? We welcome your phone calls. What do you think about these economic records of all of these people, all 10 governors and ex-governors, the most in history, as Mark has reminded us, who would be president? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. We're on Facebook as well, the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Or you may have lived in some of these states as well during these time periods, and you firsthand experienced how the economy was. We'll be with you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Mark Niquette, reporter for Bloomberg News, is with us now, and our phone number is 800-486-8655. We're looking at all the governors running for and ex-governors running for president and their economic records. And we go to Raymond in Green Bay first. Hi, Raymond.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a quick point about Governor Walker's claim taking credit for the fully funded Wisconsin retirement system. It's been fully funded for like 20 years, so I'm thinking probably he can't take credit for that.
Yes, and in fact, one of the things the other also says is that it's the only one that's fully funded in the country, and you might quibble with that too, because the data we compiled shows that Wisconsin's actually tied with North Dakota for the best, you know, pension funding ratio. It's about 99.9% as of 2013, the most recent time period.
Hmm. Did you look at that issue for other states? Because I know pension issues for state people has been really problematic in places like Illinois.
Yes, Illinois and New Jersey in particular have had trouble. It was not part of our analysis in terms of the economic indicators we looked at, but clearly it plays a role in the economy of the states and is an issue that's still being dealt with. And as I mentioned, it can also affect a state's credit rating. In the case of New Jersey, their inability to deal with their pension liability is one of the reasons behind why they've seen so many credit downgrades there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Raymond, for your call. We go to Betty next in Oak Creek. Hello, Betty.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
If I recall, when Doyle was in, before he left office, he had signed a contract to build these railroad cars, and I think they had already started building them. I'm pretty sure I'm right on this. And Walker came in, and he killed the deal, and I forget how many railroad cars and how many jobs that was supposed to produce.
Yeah, it was a Spanish company, as I recall. What was the name of it? Trago? Trago? Rail. I don't know if you looked at, this is an interesting issue when you look at federal funds that were to have come to states for rail or for expansion of Medicaid, et cetera, and the governors who did or didn't accept that and what influence that may have had on the economy of the state. I know that wasn't a part of this, but that might be an interesting study, Mark.
It would, and certainly there were instances like that where, you know, governors declined federal funding. I know I'm based in Ohio, and the governor here turned down a multi-million-dollar federal grant that had been approved by his predecessor for a high-speed rail system that he just didn't think was feasible and nobody would ride it.
Mm-hmm.
Did Wisconsin also have
yes.
a high-speed rail?
Yes, we did. The governor turned that down
I thought he was in that same mm-hmm. category. And we didn't look specifically at that, but it sort of underscores, too, one of the underlying, you know, situations with this kind of analysis. Sometimes it's hard to parse out what one factor might have in terms of the overall picture. All these, you know, factors are kind of interrelated in an economy, and one might have a particular influence, but sometimes it's hard to sort of point to one thing and say, aha, that's why this economy did well or did not do well, whatever the case may be.
Right. Betty, do you look at this issue when you're voting for president, how the economy is doing?
I vote, I'm an independent.
Yeah.
And I will vote, study the candidate, and I would definitely, because I have, my children are still in the job market, and they're working, and my grandchildren, they're having a hard time, but yes, it's very important to have jobs, and not just have jobs, but have a paying where you could live on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what my grandchildren are having problems with. They don't get the pay that probably they should get had we had a better, maybe somebody in office or economy, I don't know, because
mm-hmm.
I know that you know, you can't live on $10 an hour. You can't live on your own on $10 an hour, and a lot of them aren't even paying that.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a candidate who's capturing your fancy, Betty?
Yes, I do.
Do you want to talk about it, Betty, or not?
Well,
you don't have to. It's
okay.
Okay.
I'll tell you, I don't think I'd ever vote for him, but I do respect him simply because he's paying his own way. He's not asking for outside money, and he's not in the pockets of these wealthy, and that, of course, is Donald Trump.
Uh-huh. But you wouldn't vote for him?
I wouldn't vote for him as long as he's a Republican, no. And I do like Hillary Clinton,
uh-huh.
and I really, really like her opponent, Sandy...
Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders. I probably will be voting for him.
Uh-huh. All right. Thank you, Betty, very much for the call. I mean, I think that what she said, a lot of people feel the same thing, that people are having a hard time. You can't live on $10 an hour. It's $7.25 in some states. That's not very much money. And you factored this in, that the American dream for young people particularly seems pretty far away.
Yeah, it's playing a big role in these presidential campaigns, even in the case of Republicans. You know, this issue of income inequality, the fact that we've seen sort of the wealthiest in society rising at a time the middle class and lower class have not kept pace. You know, wages have been pretty stagnant coming out of this recession. In fact, it's been one of the lowest growth recoveries we've seen ever, really. And you're seeing these candidates sort of have to address that. And, you know, what would they do to sort of address this, you know, insecurity that a lot of people have, that, you know, they're not able to make what they need to you know, support their families, and, you know, what's their prescription for getting economic growth that's high enough to keep the whole economy humming.
Mm-hmm. You, in your study, let's go back to New Jersey and Chris Christie for a moment, talk about New Jersey's credit being downgraded 9 times, the most for a state governor. And between 2009 and 2011, the bulk of all income increases went to New Jersey's top 1% of earners. Was that true for other states in your study as well, Mark?
We didn't look at specifically, you know, what that breakdown would have been for each state, but it was sort of brought up as a factor in Chris Christie's economic record by one of the urban policy professors we talked to, just because, you know, he would make the case that Governor Christie's policy prescriptions and how he, you know, approached the job issue in particular weighed on that outcome, that you saw sort of the benefits going to the top 1% and not enough, you know, help going to the middle class.
We're talking about an interesting study that Bloomberg did, and the reporter for Bloomberg, Mark Niket, is with us this hour. Governors who would be president have mixed records on miracles. What he did was explore the economic records of the 10 governors, former governors, who are running for the White House, considering 11 economic indicators. And we're finding out where they ranked in terms of all of those indicators, and asking you, when you look at who you may support, when you look at the records of people who are running for office, do you look at these kind of indicators? Is it important whether or not a governor created a lot of jobs? Is it important that people are getting well-paying jobs? We're looking at the rankings of these governors and also what the factors were that may have put them at a little bit of a disadvantage or an advantage. What was going nationally, which was a big recession, then some of these people were governors then, so what was happening in their state was difficult for them, or maybe they were elected right after that and when things were starting to improve, so they're taking credit for that as well. Looking at the gloss that candidates can put on their economic records. Is that important to you? What do you think? We welcome your phone calls for Mark Niket. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. And I guess we can't say too much about what was happening with the economy during the tenure of some of these governors, or that they took office right after what was, just as you've mentioned, a really horrible time in American economic history. It was a horrible recession.
It really was, and particularly for those governors who started serving during that recession or coming right out of it. Times were tough, and they faced not only difficult job situations in terms of the job loss and the unemployment rate in their states when they took office, but also what it meant for their state budgets. In a lot of cases, they had to deal with shortfalls because tax revenues had fallen off the table because of the recession, and that led to some hard decisions, and in some cases became part of the governor's record. For example, in Ohio, if you listen to John Kasich on the campaign trail, one of the things he mentions a lot is how when he came into office, he was looking at about an $8 billion shortfall, and sort of touts how he was able to, pass a balanced budget as states are required to do, without any kind of tax increase. In fact, he tried to cut taxes to get to that balanced budget. And, it brings up interesting debates then about, how much of an accomplishment that is, because the critics of the governor would say, sure, he got a balanced budget and he closed that shortfall without raising taxes, but he essentially had to cut funding for schools and local governments in particular to get to the balanced budget, and that in turn forced them to face the same kind of situation, and maybe they had to raise taxes to make their ends meet.
Mm-hmm. Charlie in Milwaukee, hi.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to just say that the economic issues appear to be, at least to me, the most important, as that is the one thing that binds us all. Social policy and social views seem to affect some people more than others, while economic views affect us all very deeply. And as such, I would have to say that for Governor Scott Walker, with his economic policies, he's running for president before he's fulfilled his promises. And I'm very concerned that he is leaving, so to speak, with a job not done.
That's an interesting comment. Do you have to have a longer record, do you think, Mark, to be a legitimate candidate to fulfill those promises?
I don't know if there's a minimum time. It'll probably be up to the voters to decide, what's important to them, or how long they think a governor should have been in office, or how much time is needed before there's a record that you could fairly judge. But I think the caller's right. Almost any poll you look at, the number one issue when it comes to electing a president is the economy. That's why it's kind of surprising when you see events like the big debates we had in Cleveland last week, the first Republican presidential debate. The economy was hardly mentioned at all. We talked about a lot of different things, pertaining to the governor's records, but not a lot on economy. And I think that might be changing. I think when you see some of these debates coming up, there's going to be a lot more emphasis on the economy, because it is the number one issue for a lot of voters, and there's a lot of issues to talk about,
right,
in terms of how we deal with income inequality and some of the things you've been
yes.
talking about.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting when Betty said, she couldn't have picked people who have more different philosophies, but the people who were catching her fancy are Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, which is true for a lot of people. One, Donald Trump talks about a lot of things in sensational fashion at times, but he does talk a lot about it. He's a job creator. I create jobs. I did this. I did that. And Bernie Sanders certainly addressing pretty forcefully the issue of income inequality. Do you think that's an indication that other candidates, it would behoove other candidates to take on those very issues more?
I think so, and in fact, you are seeing it happen. Like I said before, even among Republican candidates, who you might not expect to be, as forceful on this issue as somebody, say, Bernie Sanders, who's a, a socialist. But for example, a candidate like Marco Rubio talks a lot about income inequality and, how we need to address this problem, in a structural problem, really, in our economy that prevents some people from rising and, rhetorically, makes the American dream seem somewhat out of reach. And what's interesting there is, you might have candidates talking about trying to address income inequality, but they'll have different prescriptions about how they do that. And that's where I think we need to have a little bit more discussion on the campaign trail, as opposed to, discussions about Donald Trump or celebrity or,
right.
or a lot of things that maybe aren't as important as, okay, how would these candidates go about addressing a problem like income inequality, and what economic policies would they specifically pursue to achieve that? So we as voters could sort of gauge that and evaluate whether we think, you know, this is the right prescription for that problem.
Thank you, Charlie, for your call. Let's go to Bev in Livingston. Hello, Bev.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm really listening to this because I am watching and listening to the debates, and I'm listening to what the candidates are saying about their policies, especially economic, you know, how these young kids are supposed to get jobs, and also about their care for the elderly, what they have to offer the elderly and the kids too, the children and daycare facilities. And so I'm very, very cautious and listening closely. There's a couple I'd like to see pursue, but and also, you know, Scott Walker, I just hope, I don't think that's a good idea to have him as president. I have a hard time understanding how he could take away millions of dollars in the educational field in Wisconsin, the universities and the elementary, and then sign a million some odd dollar bill for a stadium for Milwaukee basketball and the Brewers. And I, as a taxpayer, I don't want to pay half of that because I'll never be able to afford to set foot in it. So I see no sense in that stadium being built, and still the colleges and the high school and the grade school and the elementary, they're scrambling to make ends meet now. So I just don't see the fairness of that.
Thanks, Bev. And it was the Bucks, not the Brewers, just so we have that clear. Have other governors in these economic indicators, all the ones running for president, had to do similar things? Were there substantial cuts in education, Mark?
There were. We didn't look specifically at each governor's record, but I know just from covering, you know, a lot of these governors that, you know, they were faced with those kind of decisions, like I mentioned before, particularly when it came to, you know, some of their initial budgets when they came into office coming off the recession. You know, how do you go about allocating resources that gets to a balanced budget while still funding your priorities? And in a lot of cases, it did mean cuts to education and cuts to local governments. I know that was true in Ohio, where I'm based, and it was true in Wisconsin as well there. And that's some of the criticism that these governors get, that they sort of push the problem down to the local governments and the schools, and then they sort of take credit for, you know, the balanced budget and doing it without raising taxes or without cutting or by cutting taxes. And really it's just sort of pushing the problem to the local level.
Mm-hmm. As long as you're in Ohio, let's talk a little bit more about Kasich. Ohio's increase, you write, in gross domestic product under Kasich ranks ninth among all states for his years in office. What exactly does that mean, increase in GDP?
Well, essentially it's just measuring the beginning point of what the gross domestic product was for the state at the point the governor took office. In this case, it's measured by the quarter. So it's or the year before he took office, I should say. And what's the current most recent measurement of gross domestic product? So those two endpoints do a percent change, and then you can rank the states based on that percentage. And in the case of Ohio, you know, that's where he falls relative to all the other states during the same period Kasich was in office.
We're welcoming more phone calls. Mark Niket is our guest this hour. He's a reporter for Bloomberg, and he did a very interesting examination of the economic records of the people who were governors, are governors who are running for the presidency, considering 11 economic indicators and where they rank. And that's what we're talking about this hour. Of course, Governor Scott Walker is among that group, Rick Perry as well, Jeb Bush, who scored the best in this, John Kasich, Governor Chris Christie, Bobby Jindal, and others. Rick Perry, did I say Rick Perry? 10 of them. So we're looking at their economic records and asking how important those factors are to you as you consider who you're going to support for the presidency, or any questions you have about, Martin O'Malley is in that as well, the only Democrat former governor who's in that list. So it looks at these important factors, because the American economy is probably an important factor in this race. Are people addressing these issues well enough? Are they honest about what their records are? Do those records make a difference to you when you vote? And are you attracted to one candidate over another because of how well he, in this case, has performed in those areas? Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We have lines open for you right now. Our email is talk@WPR.org. The Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to Colleen in Eau Claire. Hi, Colleen.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good. I just had a comment. You know, when we go through these campaigns, I try to really keep an open mind about the Democratic and the Republican candidates, and I pay attention to a lot of different sources, and I just get so frustrated because I feel like, even though I want the information, everything, all these topics are just whitewashed, that I feel like, in a way, we're being blindsided. And I said to the screener that I really missed Tim Russert for that, because I felt like he was such a great person to really dig deep and pin some of these candidates to the wall on how they feel about certain topics.
Did you watch the Republican debate last Thursday, Colleen?
I couldn't. No, I didn't see it. We were on vacation. We didn't have a TV, but I did kind of go back and catch snips of it, and I read up on it. So I kind of know the gist of what happened, and I still feel like it was whitewashed.
Do you? I thought it was pretty good. I thought that there were some hard-hitting questions asked of the candidates. What did you think about that?
Well, I guess I kind of wanted to hear also about education, and I don't think they talked about that enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I guess... I felt like it was sensationalized a little bit, not a little bit, a lot, with Donald Trump. And, you know, I think Marco Rubio, I was shed some light with him, but, you know, I don't think Scott Walker, I would have liked to have had him answer some other questions, and he's just kind of, you know, in the background. I'd like to know how he'd handle international issues, you know, a lot of different things. So.
Yeah.
I don't know, just kind of a general feeling I have that I feel like I never really know how they're really going to handle the economy, how they're really going to handle education issues, and that's frustrating.
Right. Well, thank you. Point well taken, Colleen. Well, there are a lot of them running, too, which may be part of the reason. But what about her point that the whitewash? Can you whitewash your record so much? Did you find that was the case, Mark, that what the reality of these gubernatorial terms were is really, really at odds with what the reality is?
Yeah, sometimes it's not so much a whitewash, I don't think, but it's the context and the big picture that you need to look at. And I think that's what we kind of try to do with this story. And that is, a lot of times I think that the statements that are made are factually correct, but they don't tell the full story. Like we've been talking about during the program, you know, a governor might be able to say, you know, I had the highest median income of any state in the country. And on its face, it's true, but you need to look deeper to see, well, what else was going on in that state, or what conditions specific to that state might be playing into that outcome as much as anything the governor was going to do with policy.
And Mark, what did you think of the first debate when it came to economic issues? Did you learn some things?
Not really. Like I said before, I was surprised that we didn't get more questions about the economy. And there is a real debate to be had on economic issues and, you know, these candidates' ideas for stimulating economic growth. You know, we call it a debate. It's not really a debate, unfortunately. And you have, you know, 60 seconds to give an answer and 30-second rebuttal, you know, and really a lot of times it's just talking points that the candidates are you know, repeating from what they say on the campaign trail. But there is a legitimate difference in these candidates and how they would approach the economy, you know, whether they, you know, want to see tax cuts or, you know, a change in our tax structure. You know, some of the candidates talk about, you know, reducing a number of tax brackets, and some of this gets into the weeds, but, you know, there are very different policy prescriptions being offered, even if they don't show up in a debate like this, that need to be looked at, and I think can give some insight to voters as to who they think would have the best ideas and the best approach to stimulating the economy.
Mm-hmm. And do you know, I don't know this, whether some of the other debates, there will be, what, six of them, will concentrate more fully on the economy?
Yeah, I don't know if there's any that are topically geared that way. I guess my expectation is, though, that there will be more questions about the economy going forward, because it was sort of noticed and it was even written about out of this debate that, you know, there wasn't enough attention paid on an issue that everybody thinks is important for electing a president. I thought the value of this particular debate was the questioners from Fox News, which aired it. It seemed like their goal was to identify sort of the weakness for each candidate or, you know, the issue that's most brought up against that candidate, and just ask them straight out about it and have them address it right up front, which is kind of a good way to sort of get at, okay, if this is the candidate's biggest weakness, if you want to think about it that way, how does the candidate address it?
Mm-hmm. I know that he wasn't a former governor, but I am interested in your saying just a few words about Donald Trump. He talks a lot about job creation. The guy's a billionaire. Maybe some people are voting for him or swayed toward him because they feel that he can give them a job or something like that. How do you explain why we're spending so much attention on him and why he appears to be doing very well, at least right now?
Yeah, he's an interesting case study, really, because, you know, on the face of it, you wouldn't think he's a presidential contender from the standpoint he hasn't, you know, been in office. He doesn't really have political experience, and he's more of a celebrity than, you know, than a politician. But in a strange way, that might explain why he's having the popularity he has right now. And in fact, some of the candidates have even pointed to this, that, you know, Trump seems to sort of tap into, you know, anger that voters have about the direction of the country right now, or uncertainty they have about the economy, some of the things we've been talking about in the program, and that while he might not be the candidate out there offering, you know, the clearest policy prescription for how he would do, you know, make changes and improve things, he's at least articulating the issues in a way that people can relate to, or at least speaks to their anger or their economic insecurity. And, you know, one of the issues that probably that is highlighted the most by that is immigration, right? Because in his announcement speech, you know, he went on and on about how, you know, we need to essentially put up a fence and stop immigration. And, you know, if you talk to particularly Republican voters in these early primary states, that's a big issue for them. So, you know, they kind of appreciate the rhetoric, if nothing else. And you know, beyond that, I think, you know, part of what's going on here, too, when you look at these polls and you see Trump at the top of a lot of them, you know, you're looking at, in the case of the Republican field now, 17 candidates who are running for president. Not a lot of them are known outside their own home states. So a name like Trump, everybody knows, that's going to drive a lot of the early polling numbers.
Do you think he will be in it for the long haul?
Well, that's what's one of the more interesting things to follow in this debate. You know, conventional wisdom would say no, that, you know, this, he's not somebody who's going to, at the end of the day, be a legitimate contender for the nomination. But, you know, what's been interesting about his candidacy is he's had little steps along the way here where people have been counting him out. You know, he made critical comments about Mexicans when he announced, and people thought, well, that's going to derail him. He made critical comments about John McCain and his, you know, POW record. Mm-hmm. People thought, okay, well, that's going to derail him. And he made, you know, negative comments about Megyn Kelly, the Fox host of one of the Fox hosts of the debate, and everyone thought, okay, well, that's going to derail him, and so far it hasn't. So we'll see. I mean, it's an unusual race just because of the size
sure
of
is.
We have, but Trump brings another element that's going to make it fun to watch.
Yeah, thank you, Mark, so much. Thank you. In terms of the whole study you've done, can we get it somewhere?
Yes, if you go to Bloomberg.com, there's not a link, I don't think, on the homepage, but if you do a search under my name or under grading the governors who want to be president, you should be able to pull up the story and the chart we have.
Great.
And it is good to look at. It's an interactive chart where you can look at the different categories and the candidates and see how they stack up.
Yeah, thank you, Mark, so much.
Thank you.
Interesting hour. Mark Niquette, our guest, and if you're looking up his name, it's N-I-Q-U-E-T-T-E. He's a reporter for Bloomberg News. We thank him for being with us. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and to Scotty Myers and Katie Madsen for doing on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. And downtown Milwaukee is welcoming Irish Fest, opening today on the Summerfest grounds. We'll be speaking with a great band and with an author and the vice president coming up next hour.